think politicians are dumb. There are a lot of words they describe it that we have been left with the dumbest people. They're not educated. They don't understand what they're doing. There's no intentionality to what they're doing. And the fact is that we have been led by the smartest people in the country.
That's a bold statement. You sure about
I
that?
Think so,
you can back that up?
Ayobami Adekojo.
He's advised presidential campaigns. He's run communication strategy inside the war rooms. He's broken down delegates, primaries, minimum wage, food inflation, and the electoral map with a level of clarity most governments don't achieve.
When people are voting delegate elections in the locals, they're not doing it for altruism. They expect something back. So this is where the money parts come that people get bribed. Every single presidential candidate pay delegates. Let's say the flat rate this year is $10,000. Everybody will pay it.
But how do they agree on what the flat rate is?
Let me say the cheapest candidates. But now here's the problem. People can collect your 50K and not vote for you because this thing is not just about the money. But the networks that you make, the relationship that you make, that's the most important thing.
Break down for our audience how the mechanics of how political power actually works in Nigeria.
This is the first time I'm saying this. I hope somebody does not cut my head off for this eventually because I'm not supposed to.
Eche and I were thinking, what can we build for the most ambitious people in the world? Because that's the type of people that watch the Afropolitan podcast. So we have finally created a membership-only community
where we have 100 spots for the first 100 founding members of the Afropolitan podcast. And you get to have access to quarterly sessions between me and Chika and also in-person events. And you get access to behind-the-scenes content. You get access to our global community in six different cities across the world. And you also get to ask questions and topics that we can then filter into the show. All these come with discounts to our merchandise for the Afropolitan podcast.
Especially for those who are building in tech or raising capital and you need introductions to specific people. So we are so excited to welcome each and every one of you to the Patreon membership. Make sure to find the link in the description and I want you to join today. Ayobami. So when people click your specific video, they may be going to work on a long road trip, maybe winding down from a long day. So the first thing I want you to tell our audience is, what do most people misunderstand about Nigerian politics?
I think basically they think politicians are dumb. So there are a lot of words they describe it that we are being led with the dumbest people. They're not educated. They don't understand what they're doing. There's no intentionality to what they're doing. And I think that's the biggest misconception for me because I've like worked with these people. I know that they are some of the smartest people around. In fact, we are being led by, it's unfortunate, by the smartest people in the country.
We're being led by the smartest people in the country.
Really? Yes. Ooh, that's a bold statement. You sure about that?
So,
you can back that up?
I think, you know, when you break it down and look at individual states, look at it, the people that get to be governors of those states, they are like maybe people that have been captains of industry, people that have, now, the problem is we have a lot of crude ways that people make money in Nigeria. So, unfortunately, even if you were like a front star, you had to be the smartest one or the biggest one to be big enough to do politics. So, it's not all of those crude ways that people just like make money or they don't have the best ones out of them. So, in my state now, the governor, he was a big engineer for years.
And which state are you from?
Oyo State. So he was a big engineer for years, oil contractor, oil licensing and all that. So, and if you go around, even the ones that came from like crude businesses, they were the ones that were the most successful in those things. So the biggest misconception is that they are just dumb people just doing what they want.
Mm. But then the flip side is, so I'm going to paint a picture for you, right? So, and I'm going to compare another oil country. So let's say a lot of us, when we fly, Qatar is one of those airlines we fly. I enter Qatar. Everything is working. Everything is smooth. I did small as I was entering, what's their security? As I was entering security, I said, let me chat GPT the oil barrels because I want to understand, you know, and it's not as much as Nigeria, but yet it works. It's smooth. Now, of course, they don't have the issue of multiple languages, multiple tribes, you know, it's one band, one sound, 100%, right? But what is it? Why can't we have our own like this?
I think the question answers itself a bit with, like, they have, like, an homogeneous culture. And in Nigeria, it's very hard for us to agree on anything. It's very, very hard. Let me give you an example. We had a coup in Benin recently.
Yes.
There was one in Niger before that. We intervened in Benin, but we did not intervene in Niger. because the Northerners did not want us to intervene in Niger. Basically, white people came and drew a line in the sand. In Niger, cousins live across the border from each other. You are in Nigeria, I'm in Niger, but they are family members. So it's very tough to... I mean, it's the same in Benin, because we have like Yoruba communities and across the border. But it's very important for us to intervene in Benin because it has a border with our economic nerve center, which is Lagos. But in Niger, the Northerners would not agree to that. So when you have like a multicultural, heterogeneous society like that, it's very hard to govern because it's not a nation of like shared ideals. You are as different from a typical core Northerner as you are from maybe a Jewish person or an Arabic person. That's how different you are from them. But you are all supposed to like, you know, have shared ideals in one nation. So it's something that is very tough. I'm not giving excuses. We also have the population problem. If you are going to like look at the barrels of oil, our population is exploding. And we are above 200 million now. There are some projections that will be at 300 million. And we are still focused on the same oil that we, you know, since 1962 or something, we still don't know how to get the oil from the ground. We just do JVs with international companies. So we are still focused on that. And there's just no way out when you have large population and a heterogeneous country with poor geography. We have poor neighbors. So you are not getting, we are prisoners of geography, basically.
Okay. I know Eche is there waiting. He's waiting to be tapped in. But I have another follow-up though to this, because I'm just trying to paint the picture, right? Because yeah. I know this conversation is very important. I think it's the first time we're really talking about it from a base level of how politics work in Nigeria and Africa at large. So I want to understand, because recently I was speaking to someone and I was saying, you know, is it that Nigeria just needs to go back to regional rule? Oh, you smile. And then someone interestingly said, it looks like there's some things happening for that. But I don't know, right? Because I'm not in there enough to understand. So what do you think about that?
Personally, I'm not in support of regional rule.
Oh.
Personally.
Interesting.
And I've had these debates with so many people, so many like forward-thinking Nigerians, so many young Nigerians. And the reason is that over the years, we've built state identities. Like I just said, I'm from Oyo State. There are people from Osun State. So the mistake people make when they talk about regional rule is that they don't realize that almost the same problem we have with minorities happened with regional rule. So when there was the Eastern region, the minorities in the Eastern region, they believed they couldn't get anything. When it was Western region, the minorities, before the Midwest broke out, then the Northern region, you have the North Central. What happens to them? There are Christian communities in the North Central. The major problem we have today is because they are lumped up with the North. So you go to Southern Kaduna, you go to Taraba, you go to Nasarawa, there are Christian majority places. And then when you go to regional rule, they are never going to get anything. You are better off in Nigeria as a nation because the new CDS, Chris Musa, is from Southern Kaduna. He's never going to get that within another Nigeria. Like a Christian will never get to rule or do anything of note. So the current structure protects the minorities more than, because we've been able to fragment it in such a way that within your own people, you can actually be something. Aside politics, your people can aspire to be something, and then you can, you know, carry them along in that way. So that's one problem I have with regional rule. I don't generally have a problem with it. I know that people feel like it was working well, but if it was working so well, you not have a coup that then you blame an entire tribe of people for trying to take over, because that's what happens. Now, let's say the president is from the Southwest, then it's their turn. So they have to take all their people into Abuja and, you know, largesse and everything. And you just keep doing that. So the state identities that we've built, whatever state that you're from, people have been able to socialize and build dreams together, build things together. And I think we just need more fiscal federalism, where states have more autonomy to do things, where they can regulate their own laws. And for them to retain more of the proceeds from their resources, like the Niger Delta should be better. We get all the money from there, it should be better. There is 30% derivation. I don't think it's enough. Lagos should be better from like the VAT that is being shared all across the country. States like Oyo with lithium and cobalt and things, you know, you should be able to retain your resources in states. So that's what I think we need to focus on with the state identities that we already have than regional rule. But you said there are some, yes, there are more, actually, there are more moments that, you know, in this president's second term, he was definitely going to consider it. And I wouldn't put anything past him. I wouldn't put anything past his team. I've spoken with some of them. I think there are some fundamentalists in there that would not mind. But I will not advise it. It's not, I don't think it's the way to go.
I think this is where I've been waiting to come in. And I think I wanted this episode to be a masterclass on how politics works in Nigeria, but also parts of Africa as well. Now, when we think through, especially a lot of people in the diaspora, because I've been in these conversations where I'm like, man, you guys really don't understand how things happen on ground, and you keep applying it. It's not Democrat, Republican, yeah. It's not Tory, Labour. This is a very nuanced perspective, right? What I want you to do is break down for our audience how the mechanics of how political power actually works in Nigeria. You know, you wrote a Substack article a couple of years back where you broke down delegates and primaries, ward mobilization, LGA structures, how governors also control party mechanisms, right? Some people in the diaspora think, oh, it's just about somebody who has the most money and then they win, right? Can you break down the nuances of how political power works in Nigeria?
I think it depends on what position or what area you're looking at. The article you're talking about, I think it's a very good thing that we had the last election because a lot of young people were involved because there was a candidate that young people wanted to support. That's Peter Obi. And I, even though I was on the other side, I really liked the fact that it was happening because all the years I've been saying young people need to vote. It's unfortunate for me that when they came out, it was not the candidate I wanted. But I really liked that it happened anyway because it opened people's eyes into things that they didn't know about. And at the beginning of that conversation, you know, it was in the PDP, which the same party I was, and he wanted to contest for primaries. And everybody just said, article bribe delegates and everything goes that way. So that's why I wrote the article, because it's not, at the end of the day, let me just start from the end. The person that spent the most money was not the one that won. So it's not that easy. It's something that happens over the years. It's years of political power. So now there are what Congress is in words. And when you want to join politics, say anybody here wants to join politics, for example, they will say, go to your ward. You get a card from your ward. Your ward is like your locality. It's where you are from. For some of us, it's basically just extended family. So, and that's where it gets interesting, because one of the things that they calculate is that did you win your polling unit? Because that's supposed to be your family. If you don't have something, I think everywhere in the world, if your family people do not like you, then why are you talking to the externals? So you get your ward, and they do what Congress is. And in what Congress, they choose what delegates. And so after choosing those ward delegates, when it's time for, say, local government elections, they are the ones that choose the candidates. And then from there, they do local government delegates. Those are the ones that choose candidates for, say, state assembly elections, say, House of Rep elections as well. Then you do senatorial level candidates. Those are the ones that choose delegates for senatorial. Now, a lot of these things, I'm not saying has not been corrupted. That, for example, when you have a governor from a state, except the governor has like some godfather that is like, that literally just put him there. The governor is in charge of all these things I'm saying. So the governor basically just writes a list instead of actual the democratic process of doing the world congresses. The governor basically just says, this is who I want here, this is who I want there. So at the end of the day, in that kind of situation, if you want to be president and you need those delegates from that state, you need to do us trading with the governor. And that's why the governors get so powerful. That's because they are the ones in control of those delegates. So in exchange for that, they usually ask that, oh, I want to be VP, or I want my man to be VP, or I get to choose the minister from my state. So that's one way that it goes when you are choosing delegates. For national conventions now, you now have delegates from each local government in every state. For states that maybe your party does not govern, that's the most exciting thing for any politician, because there's no governor. Now we are all slugging it out. We are all trying to edge each other out. If I can become the delegate from my own local government, I'm good. And mind you, when people are voting delegate elections in the locals, when they are choosing you to go and be the one to vote for them in Abuja, they are not doing it for altruism. They expect something back. So this is where the money parts come, like, you know, that people get bribed. If you are the delegate from your local government now, you started some people, and some people are expecting that. Whatever you are getting in Abuja when you go, I'm getting some of that. So actually, everybody pays. I'm not going to come here. I don't want to come here and lie or anything. So it's because it's important for people to know what's going on. Every single presidential candidate pays delegates. There is, when everybody gets to Abuja, they sit in certain your hotels, they come, they do an hotel run and check. This is after they've gone through the country and paying them anyway. So, but the final payment, it comes in that way. And say, let's say the flat rate this year is $10,000. Because somebody will say, I want to pay above the flat rate because I want it this bad. But let's say the flat rate, everybody will pay it.
But how do they agree on what the flat rate is? Who sets the bar?
So let me say the cheapest candidates, whatever the cheapest
candidates can, what the cheapest candidate can afford.
Yeah, what the cheapest candidates can afford. So let's say maybe HE Peter or B is paying 5K. That's the flat rate. So another candidate can come and say, you know what, I'll give you guys 7K. Then somebody else say 10K. But now here's the problem. People can collect your 50K and not vote for you.
Because you don't actually know who they vote for.
It's blind vote.
It's a blind vote.
So what you need is that political presence, the horse trading that you're able to tell political leaders in states that, you know, you have to vote for me. But the most important thing that delegates consider and people don't understand is the ability to win election. There's one thing that is more important than whatever 10K or 15K you're getting in Abuja. It is that your party is in power next time, because then that's where whatever, if you are so selfish that, you know, you are in politics for money, you are going to gain more money. You are just being short-sighted if you collect 10K and there's nothing for the next 4 years. But if your party is in power, there are positions, there are contracts, there is, you know, and there, maybe you believe in your party, you believe in your party's economic plan that this will be good for me. So it's what they actually consider, that who can deliver this election for us. Let me give you an example. The APC, the last time, because the PDP had the convention before APC, and they had problems in choosing. They were waiting for Buhari to nominate somebody, even though, like, Tinubu had immense power with governors and wealth. They were still waiting for Buhari to change it. But immediately Atiku and Not Wike won the PDP primaries. Even the Tinubu camp knew that, I mean, even the Buhari camp knew there's only one person that can defeat Atiku in the national election. And Osibajo was never going to defeat in the national election. Dave Umahi was never going to do that. Senator Akpabio was never, like, let's be realistic. If you want to stop PDP from winning this election, this is the only other person, because he has extensive network and he's also a money bag. And for people that are outside, they only see, like, the money bags. And that's the mistake. A lot of people, you know, they message me from the UK, US. They want to come to Nigeria and do politics. And the first thing they say is, oh, what should be my budget? I said, why is that the first consideration? Because money is, a lot of people come, spend a lot of money and pack their bags and go back. And they spend more than the person that eventually won. Mm. So when they ask me, like, oh, how much? I'm like, why is that your phone? Because this thing is not just about the money. You're going to spend the money. Don't. But the networks that you make, the relationship that you make, that's the most important thing. It's really, really important to actually know the people that you want to govern and understand their politics, understand little nuance in how, what they aspire to be. There are some things that maybe as educated as you are, as progressive as you are, that you want, and the people don't want it. Mm. So how do you, sorry for going back to my state, the governor proposed this very expensive circular road thing. It's supposed to be a road around Ibadan. So people that, because Ibadan is a gateway between the south and the north when you move goods from the so that people don't need to enter Ibadan and cause traffic again and just, like, get the road done. The problem is they needed a lot of demolitions. So at the beginning, as a policy advisor, I advised them, I don't think this thing is going to work, especially when you want 500 meters from the road demolition. Everybody in the room said, I beg, we are going to go ahead with it. Now there are protests, there are this thing. The governor is saying, okay, that's fine, we'll do it 150 meters. Okay, that's fine, we'll not do it this side. So the reality is coming in. Your plan might be grand and beautiful, but what do the people want? What exactly? So you need to be able to, you know, be able to do that and know what they want. It's the most important thing, not just the money. And that's how like politics actually work in the country, because people in the lower social class, they know how to organize. Politics is all about organizations. They have associations of tailors, association of this and that. If a politician does this now, you can get 5,000 people in a room. But you can't get 5,000 educated people in a room, which is what is special with what Peter Obi did in the last election, because he was able to get 5,000 educated people in a room. And that's not what politicians are used to. And that's why more educated people need to like organize themselves more. Because the people that we abuse that, you know, vote these politicians, they organize very well. And the person might be looking for air dryer. Maybe she's starting a salon. Maybe that's what she's looking for. And she's going to get it. To you, you're like, empowerment program with air dryer. But she worked hard. She went to world meetings. She voted for this person and she's getting her air dryer. Now you know. Now you know. Because they organize very well and they get the things they want. So the question is, what they want maybe is not what is best for the society or what they deserve, but they get what they want in organizing that well.
Etcher, remember that time I walked into a bank, I'm not going to give the name, and I asked them for $1,000 and they told me no, they cannot withdraw any dollar for me. And I was so upset. And I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have V-Band to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have V-Band as a sponsor for the Afropolitan podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast.
There was some time I did some work with Lagos State. This was years ago when I was running a software company. And I got to talk to the civil servants. So I saw it on ground, you know, what they want, what was important to them, you know, who the different people I had to talk to. And I always say to myself, as much as we complain about the government, I personally think we get what we deserve.
Yeah.
Right. Can you talk more about that? Because I think people don't understand this thing you're saying of that person that just wants the dryer, you know, and I think some of us elites are far removed from what the actual average Nigerian wants. Like, what have you seen being in politics?
So when you're in politics and you go for these meetings, you meet people and you talk to them and you realize that what they really want, what they want to see from government is totally different from what people think. I was talking to an House of Rep member. I told him to help me note the requests from home, like education, healthcare. I just told him to help me note it for research purpose. And you won't believe it. It's from Ibadan, so we like partying. Most of the requests...
Wambe.
Wambe. I'm not even joking.
Then wait. What do you mean?
Most of the requests are for him to sponsor...
Parties.
Parties.
Okay. So they just say, please, yeah.
My son's freedom. My son's freedom. My child's graduation party, wedding, burial. That's like
jollof rice for the
62% of the requests before you come into education.
So wait, I'm confused. So did he clearly say, like, what did he say to them? And this
he
was
didn't
the
say anything to them, like, he's the House of Rep member.
Okay.
They call him like for requests.
Yeah. That's how you would call your congressman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, okay,
yeah,
okay,
they call
him
for requests. Okay. And most of the requests he receives is to donate to their upcoming party or attend in person. Like, that's the majority, followed by education. And the education sometimes is a lie for them to
do the party.
To do the party. And this is serious. Like, they can ask for anything. These are like party leaders or this thing that are close to him. And that's the majority of the requests you receive. So if you are somebody that is strict and maybe you are abroad educated, you are very strict, you came home. And I think that's another...
Because I want to go to that Twitter.
I was going to go into something that Pashola said about politicians' children not being able to carry on the mantle. And I think that's a lot of the problem. their children are abroad educated and have seen life. They can't do the same type of creep politics that they do. It's very tough to do. The streets I grew up in Ibadan, it's like filled with people that their parents are politicians. And I can tell you for free that I'm the only one still in Nigeria. I'm the only, every other person in the US or UK. Eventually, some of these guys will come back to run on their parents' names. And I cannot see how they are going to connect with the people as much. I can't see it. I'm not, I know that, you know, I'll work with some of them and try to tell them, wow, now like this is B now. But I can't see how they, because when we have conversations, they're always like, wow, this will disturb me. Or maybe we'll go somewhere together. I'm being attentive to somebody or talking like deeply with somebody. I'm like, why did you disturb yourself with that person? So I can't see. And that's the problem we have with like, educated people on Twitter, all this thing. That connection is very hard, because if somebody keeps asking somebody at that level of education, about graduates, that, oh, my child's one better. Like, are you dumb? Let me just fix your road. You are going to be able to afford, but they would rather you do that than whatever road. There are communities that people will go into, they want to start a road program, and the kings and stuff, they will say, give us the money. People want that quick win because they don't get to see much from government anyway. So they want quick wins from government. And it's that way, it's a very big problem. That's class division. And you wonder, why did they keep voting for this party? Why? What? I'm sorry to say once again, they get what they want. Maybe it's not what they deserve. But when they set their goals out, like, this is what I want from this person, usually they get it. If they don't get it, they vote for somebody else the next time. But why do they keep voting for that person? It's because they get what they want, majorly what they want. So it's unfortunate, but that's just the reality of what's going on.
I was telling someone the other day, and I think you might have tweeted about this, like, back in the past, which was, you know, everyone's always complaining about the Nigerian system or African system. It's not working. It's not responsive. The government obviously can do better. But I was saying to them that people don't also realize that over a long enough timeline, the government has actually become more responsive to people's demands, whether it's because of the transparency that comes from social media, being able to amplify certain things. Like, I think the other day they closed this road in Lagos and everyone was complaining. And then now they're like, okay, they're going to shift it. Can you help articulate that for people where on a long enough timeline, it's not to say that change happens overnight, but that change has happened where before you could have complained into a microphone all day long to a blue in the face, nothing would happen. What role has social media and the transparency that's come from having the cameras on our phones, what role has that played in holding government accountable?
So powerful. In fact, people don't know how powerful they are. I've seen billionaire politicians show me a random Andrew with 100 followers saying, please, who is this person? And why are they saying this about me? Like, how can we solve this? Like, I'm trying to, maybe somebody complained about an health center. I've been trying to get the contractors to do it. Like, this is just a random person. So that's how much they're afraid of social media, because they don't get it like we do. If somebody goes on social media and tweets, HA this, and just check this page, I beg. But trust me, for a politician, he's scared. He's still thinking about it when he's asleep, because people normally don't talk back to them daily.
Yeah.
They have yes men around them. Now you have somebody on social media, a random person, like, Senator, something is a fool. And he's like, what? And he's fixated on it. And he tells you, like, as a client, like, okay, please help me with this. I'm not going to call anybody to delete their tweets. You said there is work on this thing going fine. Yeah. Then the next day is like, that guy still has it on. So, social media has created this thing that I can see the fear in myself. Like, I can see it a lot of times, even before they make decisions, you see people come to ask you, like, how will people react to this? And how can we mitigate whatever reaction it is to this? There is a lot of consideration for social media every time. And the organization that happened with NSAS was something that had never been seen before.
I wanted to talk about that.
It had never been seen before. I spoke to a lot of people because I was protesting myself, and they were shocked that I was protesting myself. And I spoke to them, and they were really shocked at how everything just came together and
so
people
quickly.
Were coming together so quickly. Because one of the fears, obviously, I said organization happens at the lower level, but it doesn't happen at the middle class level. We don't really know what we want. We don't. Everybody's hustling, and you know, so you can't really attend meetings, you can't really agree with people. Like, whatever you are gaining, you feel somebody else is losing. Whatever you are losing, somebody else feel they're gaining.
The right race.
It's very competitive in the middle class. People don't really have time to come together. But during NSAS, middle-class children came out and were in control of things. And it was a scary situation for politicians, because if middle-class children come together, then, you know, you are finished. If you look through history, most activists are people that are from middle class, like Fela Kuti or Wole Soyinka,
MLK.
Like, you need some form of education and background to be, to even have the thoughts. You can't be a street thug. I mean, you could be, but you are, there won't be tact to it. People would rather, you know, is MLK and Malcolm X situation, right? Like, with Malcolm, you're like, I beg, he's just shouting. But with MLK, this guy is actually planning something, you know? So there's something there. So when middle-class people came together during NSAS, it became something huge, and it was powered by social media.
Yeah.
And all the security reports that the president got was that they wanted to do a coup.
That's what they filtered to him.
That's what they filtered to him, you know. And, you know, the man did multiple interviews before he died. And that's what he kept saying, you know, when those young people wanted to come and take over, it's practically impossible to do a civilian-led coup in Nigeria, because has anybody ever been to Aso Rock? So you can see it's a fortress.
There's many layers.
Yeah, it's a fortress. Inside, yeah. You know, when it was in Boni Camp, we can just pack ourselves and go there. But how are you going to even march from Lagos down to Abuja in the first place? So it's very tough to do. And we don't have that type of culture. But what they filtered to him was that it was a coup. You know, it was mostly happening in the Southwest. Then within the Southwest, they tried to break them down across tribal lines too, that, oh, it was these people that were doing it and that. So that eventually they were able to, you know, do that break. But because it happened in the first place, it created that fear for social media that when these people come together and do a lot of things, you have to respond very fast. With my example from before, tweets with zero retweets gets to them, because these people are actually going onto their phones and search their names. And then they see
this on Twitter, Instagram.
So they see these things, and I've seen a lot of responses to tweets, because somebody, you know, there was this thing that Senator Ned Nwoko, popular for something else right now, but he did like a school a football pitch. Then some guy went there to say, oh, it's a lie, look at the entrance, and no. And immediately the contractor went back to work. You know, the post was viral, and immediately the contractor went back to work. I've seen people, you know, claim that they did this premier healthcare, and a local just went there and posted on Facebook, and now the contractor is back at work. So social media has created that thing, that transparency, and there are organizations like Budget Tracker on social media that people follow, that actually follow through these projects. And it has improved the country a lot. It has improved our electionary process as well, because, you know, results in real time. People coming together in real time to say, oh, you know what, we are going to be in Ikeja today. What are you going to do about that? No, like, let's be for real. What are you going to do about that? Before, you need to say it on radio, and they were in control of radio. You need to say it on TV, they were in control of TV. But now, a random dude has 500,000 followers. He's not one of you guys. He has never contested for election. You don't know his father. You don't know, you know, like, these are people that you cannot even... You know, I was a bit wild and radical when I started on social media, and I had people call my parents because they know them. And my mom is calling me like, what's going on? So now imagine people that you don't even know them. And, you know, there are several channels that you can't control, that you just can't do anything about. And it has increased our transparency. There's a video of Tinubu saying, oh, I don't check social media anymore because they insult me a lot.
I don't need social media anymore. They abuse hell out of me. If I read it, I get high blood pressure. I get angry. I don't read it.
One, I know he still checks it. Two, but look at the time that he was checking it and seeing the insults. It has improved the perception game. There are a lot of things that they do. Like when they did the pardon thing and people shouted like, why are you pardoning murderers and kidnappers? Then they changed it around. I said, oh, it's not the final decision, so they're not going to. It's because of social media noise. So things like that, we are able to govern ourselves better when we... that's why I encourage people, like, if you see anything that is wrong, just say it. Just post it. Like, don't even ignore the fact that maybe you might know the person or something. Just post it. It's totally fine, because they will see. Trust me, they see everything that is going on. So, and it improves governance a lot.
I remember when NSARS was happening, I think you and I have spoken about this, how over time Nigerians or even young Nigerians don't tend to know the history of the past, right? I remember seeing things like, you know, we're not our parents' generation or we're not our grandparents' generation. They can't try this one with us. And then you're like, bro, this is not the first protest that's ever happened in Nigeria by young people, right? Mm-hmm. Can we talk through some of the differences and similarities between the Hong Kong demonstrations and the NSARS demonstrations, and also talk through this historical point as well? What were some of the mistakes you think that NSARS made, and what is the grace that you give them? Because at the end of the day, nobody prepares to go become an activist. But I think as students of history, which we are, there were things where we're like, bro, if you had just read this book, or if you had just read this article here, you would know that this same mistake you're making here, the people who came before you made it, maybe we should just do this other thing here versus, you know, these other things. So can we just break down some of the nuances and the differences in organizational ability between the Hong Kong demonstrations and then NSARS as well?
I think with NSARS, you know, when it started, we said it was leaderless. Everybody was doing things their own. But at the end of the day, we needed the organization. And I like the fact that FEMCO stepped in. I like the leadership and they were very, very responsive. A young boy died in Ogbomoso from my state. And, you know, I reached out to them. And immediately, you know, we got my lawyer in Ibadan and they were in contact, compensation for the family immediately and everything. And it was so swift. And I really liked that was going on. And then there were the protests in Lagos and the food for people, logistics and everything. And it was going on well. But the problem is we needed more than FEMCO because obviously the people that you are fighting against are very, very strong with propaganda. So once they notice that, okay, this is where the organization is coming from, it's easy to get into that and say, oh, so they started with, oh, it's a feminist agenda that they are collecting money from abroad, which we're raising a lot of money from abroad. And then they pulled some people back with that. While they were pulling people back, I wish that we grew like several heads for the Hydra, that another group was also doing their own thing. But immediately, people within FEMCO started feeling like, okay, maybe the heat is getting too much. There are people that are within that they were able to contact maybe their parents or, you know, threaten their businesses and things like that. When they started walking back, there was nowhere for us to go again.
It was a vacuum.
Yeah. And this was even before the shooting that happened. We were already a bit relaxed. And another thing is that we reached a crescendo where we didn't know what we want anymore. Like nobody could articulate. So the whole no leader thing also became a problem because, okay, now you guys have been protesting for 2 weeks. What do you want? They ended SARS. Like, I had the potential that called me, like, guy, I see you for protest. We don't end SARS. Like,
you know, also, like, they disbanded SARS.
Yeah, they did.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they did.
Within 3 or 4 days into the protests, they disbanded SARS, and the president released a statement that, you know.
Really?
Yes.
Wait, did you guys know that?
Yeah, they so did. Did you see SARS again? Did you see them?
So we didn't have anything. So it was becoming end bad governance. That's why Buhari believed the coup.
I don't think people in the diaspora knew this, though. Maybe. Because we were protesting 2 weeks into.
But I also think, so going back to this FEMCO thing, I think the challenge was they started becoming a little bit bigger than the message itself.
Yeah.
And they started getting diluted because it's like, okay, what is the clear agenda? And I remember there was multiple people meeting, but it's like, what as a youth, what are we trying to say? What are we trying to do?
So also, I think the other aspect where you can give grace is once they have accepted
to NSARS,
you're like, actually, you know what? My light is not working.
So that's what happened. My roads are so not working. So people were like, end bad governance, end this, end that. Because they ended SARS immediately. like I said, somebody called me and said, guy.
So I did not know.
I didn't know you're an anarchist. You said answers. We don't answer. Like, bro, just get back into the house. So we didn't have a clear agenda of what we wanted. Yeah, we at that point we could have asked for anything and they would have given it, but we did not know what to ask for. And you know, they had already, you know, pushed their own PR people out, and then bad actors started getting into the mix. Bad actors were usually sent by the government, obviously, to stop the protests. They are the ones, like I said, lower level organization. They were able to, you know, take them out. Which ironically, we had those bad actors, we had them supporting us at the beginning.
Yeah, they did.
But obviously, we're not going to incentivize them. Like, why should we pay thugs for protection or a protection racket? So it was easy for the government to flip them to the other side. And this was before the violence or anything. The message was already getting a bit weak because we're going out every day. We're just saying government is bad. But the government had just been elected. I think it was 2 years into Buhari's election or something. Like, there's another election coming up. What are you guys doing? There's nothing we can do. At that point, we could have had better leadership and articulated something and, you know, had proper engagement. But unfortunately, it did not happen. So I think that's one thing we need to learn from. Like, even if you are going to be leaderless, you need, for the Hong Kong guys, they knew what they wanted. Like, oh, this is this particular law. We don't want this repatriation law into China or this thing. But immediately they ended us, we didn't have any point anymore being on the streets. I was still on the streets because at that point, we just wanted to, you know, show that we can come together and show the government what we can do. But there was no moral justification for it anymore. And there was, immediately the pressure came on the organizers with, we didn't know what to do. And there were no other heads to the Hydra. It was just the same set of people. And then people realized, oh, they can also throw in their own agenda. And then it started. And the government by that time said, end this, and we're not ending it. And they, you know, ended it with that very bloody day, which is unfortunate. One way or the other, I knew it was going to happen because they felt that's the only way this is going to end. These people are just going to stay there and we don't know what will happen. Maybe external factors come and help them or something. So we need to end this now. And they ended it in their own way. So the lesson for me is to have different heads and to actually have a focused message before we do anything like that. Mm. For example, what we have now in the country is a cost of living crisis. Things are very expensive. Inflation is very high. Interest rate is very high. Somebody that does business myself, it's very, very tough to get. It's easy to get a loan. It's very tough to pay back because the percentage is just insane. So I think if anything like that happens, we already know the problem that we have and its cost of living. And if what we're asking is for subsidy to be back or whatnot, let's just stick to that message and know that this is what we are taking to the government.
From a, I think, political strategist perspective, because you were also part of Atiku's campaign, when you were watching the primaries happening at APC and you knew, obviously, there's a bunch of people who were running to become the APC primary candidate. And just for the viewers watching, in Nigeria, we have two political main political parties, the PDP, People Democratic Party, and APC, All Progressive Congress. And then the last election, we had Labour Party come up with Peter Obi. But just to paint the picture here, you're watching the primaries, because I think some of us are watching it on TV. And, you know, there are all these talks about, okay, who is Buhari going to support? Who is he going to, you know, favor? And then you see these guys going up there and then saying, I am delegating my people to Tinubu. What did it feel like to you? Because me and you play chess and you whoop me all the time. So let's just put that on record. Well, from a chess perspective and a political strategist perspective, what did that feel like? And did you anticipate this was what was going to happen at the time? But what did it feel like just seeing a master at work in this particular arena?
So I think for years, Tinubu should not be underrated. Because, you know, he sits down and is always looking. So it's easy to feel like you're smarter than him. But there is something within that just sit down, look thing. And it happens a lot in the political arena as well, that people look at him like, this guy looks dumb to me. I can't, you know, run rings around him. But you are never going to do that. And this is aside from the war chest. He's very smart himself, aside from being able to afford the smartest people in the world. I mean, and you will be very surprised, like, a lot of smart people that you know day to day that actually work with him, they won't come out and say, oh, and provide strategy for him. You'll be quite surprised, like, oh, so come in your pocket too. So, I knew that immediately we chose Atiku, they had only one thing, and it was sustainable. Else, bro, it's a PDP victory.
Wait, sorry, before you go on, can you break down what the difference would have been? Because I didn't necessarily ever think Wike had that much of a chance to win. So it wasn't Atiku already projected to be the primary winner. It wasn't as straightforward as that.
It wasn't straightforward at all.
Okay.
So initially, personally, going into the primaries, I was supporting Bukola Saraki. That's the same person I supported every primary, although we get beaten at the primaries. But that day was Wike's day. It was a crowning for Wike.
Really?
In fact, yes. In the arena that day, when Wike walked in, like, I know people that walked out. I was almost walking out myself until I got a text message from, like, let's just stay in this. Because the everywhere erupted. He went round. That's why he was so confident to go out, to give that speech. Whoever wins here today, I will support the person. He was looking for support for himself. Because he was going to win.
Yeah.
The numbers were in his favor. Everything was in his favor.
Wait, so what happened?
It was the ISB there as well. So that's where I'm coming to. You know, I said when he walked in, people wanted to walk out. One of those people that walked out, Atiku. Atiku walked out when Wike walked into the loud ovation. Whatever he did within the next, I don't know, 1.5 hours when he walked out, whatever phone calls he made, whoever he spoke to, they are the movers and shakers of this country. Because Atiku walks out after Wike's ovation. He walks back in. He walked around the delegates. They were hailing him, but it was still not as loud as Wike's ovation. But something in the hall had changed.
Energy like, had changed. The energy you had could changed. Feel it.
Yes, I could feel it. I was telling the guy beside me, like, I feel like Atiku don't go do something. You know, there was just something different about it. And the thing that Wike did not calculate was that Tambuwal thing, which, to be fair to Wike, should never have happened. Because what happened was, you go, you give your speech. You go, you give your... So everybody gave their pitch to the delegates. After the pitch, it was voting time. Then Tambuwal was allowed to go back on stage.
So who was Tambuwal for our viewers?
Okay, Tambuwal was governor of Sokoto State.
Okay.
At that point, he was governor of Sokoto State. He was the one in control of Northwest delegates. You know, I told you that
the governor controls the
control. So Tambuwal was in control of Sokoto delegates, but Northwest delegates were split. Kano, for example, they were Wike, via Kwakwa. So they were, in fact, the Kano guys were wearing Wike caps. They let us know, and they had the most delegates. They were already wearing Wike caps. Like, forget everything that is happening here. Tambuwal then goes back to the stage to say, I'm stepping down after giving his speech. So that if Wike is angry with that, I don't agree with him anymore because he has gone batshit crazy since then. But on that night, I don't think that should have been allowed. Tambuwal then went back on stage to say he's stepping down and all his delegates should vote for Alhaji Atiku Abubakar. So two things. If you are going to say you are stepping down, step down and leave the stage. You cannot tell all your delegates to then vote for somebody. Right voting there. Time. People are already on the queue to vote. So immediately that happened, there was no way for Wike, because in every calculation, we're calculating Tambuwal to get votes, not that Atiku owned Tambuwal's votes.
Oh, okay. So Tambuwal was running for a primary as well.
Tambuwal was running for primaries as well.
And almost pushed it.
Interesting.
And Tambuwal was, in fact, Tambuwal almost had as more delegates as Atiku. Because don't forget, Tambuwal came second in the previous primaries when he was with Wike. So Tambuwal was very strong in the party at that point because he was the only governor in the Northwest and he was controlling a lot of delegates from the North. So he went back on stage and then the Northern Alliance happened. Everybody was just looking at each other like, what's going on here? Which is unfortunate. This is the first time I'm saying this. I hope somebody does not cut my head off for this eventually because I'm not supposed to. Tambuwal, my own candidate that I was supporting, Saraki, and Bauchi governor now, they had a pact that they can only step down for each other. And because they wanted to be the new Young Turks in the North, they wanted to edge Atiku out. Like, whatever happens, if there will be a Northern Alliance, they went to IBB, General Gusau called them, and no. So that morning, I know I'm saying too much by this point, but it's fine. That morning, General Gusau already called them again, and, you know, this time, can you guys just step down for Atiku? But that was not the plan. So everybody else went in and believed that. In fact, when Tambuwal was going in, they thought that, oh, okay, he's going to do it for us now, before he then said, do it for Atiku. So, like I said, the phone calls that Atiku had when he left the hall, whoever convinced Tambuwal eventually, because if he was part of the clan before, he would have said it during his speech.
Yeah.
He would have said it like, so because that was what the APC guys did when he was stepping down for Tinubu.
Yeah.
Because the normal thing is it was part of the conversation. Yeah. But whatever happened at that point, it was over for Wiki.
Wait, sorry. So the PDP one is actually more juicier than the APC one. APC. I didn't even know this.
Those guys went to Crown.
That was a normal situation.
Yeah, it was very straightforward. That was a normal,
yeah.
But you're saying in an hour, 30 minutes, whatever calls were made convinced Mandem like, yo, it's time to go.
To go, yes.
So that means he had some strategists on his team.
Yes,
that
he did.
Looked at around at and round. Said,
like, immediately,
we're not there yet.
Yeah. Immediately Wike came in and I saw the ovation. I wanted to leave. Like, I was so mad. Like, wow, Wike really will be the presidential candidate of this party. There's no escaping this. Like, it's over. So, whatever anger that Wike has for the PDP today, I understand it. Because if I'm almost there like that, like, if I add it like that, and you take it from me.
It's in my hand.
Yeah.
What did it look like? Because I think from everybody who was watching, who was not in the know, you're watching these primaries and the whole chatter going in, Tinubu is washed. He's not going to be the candidate. Yeah. Osinbajo is going to be the candidate. You could feel like they wanted to crown somebody new.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the next thing you know, you're watching a procession of people go up there and then, you know, basically pledge their delegates to Tinubu.
Yeah.
What did that look like from a strategist level? Like, for people who don't know how these things work, you're like, wait, we're hearing this thing here. What did that look like for you? And can you break it down for our audience?
I think going into the primaries, Tinubu had too much sway with governors for him not to have won. The only person that could have stopped it that day was Buhari walking to the podium himself to say, vote this person. The president has immense power in Nigeria, way too much power. In fact, the Nigerian president is relatively more powerful than the US president, like within things that you can control. There are things that, you know, there are judges stopping Trump from doing things now. There's no Nigerian judge that is making a proclamation against the president. It's just never going to happen. So Buhari could have stopped whatever Tinubu was planning. But the problem with going against somebody like Tinubu is that you would have to fight. And Buhari does not like getting himself into, as military and general as he is, things have come to him soft one way or the other. When he faced anything, they cooped him out. So he's not a fighter.
Yeah.
So the problem is when you disagree with Tinubu, that's just the beginning. You have to fight. You may win, but you'll be like, you have a bloody nose. So I think ultimately Tinubu knew that Buhari would not want to fight and he had the best strategy. Both Amaechi and Osinbajo were waiting on Buhari to crown them and say, this is what I want. And don't forget that Buhari eventually did even like play a card when the party chairman came out to say that Buhari said Lawan should be the candidate because he was the only northerner on the ticket. And they were afraid that with Atiku winning the PDP ticket, only northerner can defeat him. And Buhari never denied that he didn't tell the party chairman that Lawan should be the candidate. Again, the problem is for you to install your Lawan, you need to fight. Nobody was willing to fight. And Tinubu had the war chest and governors in his pockets to fight. Somebody like El-Rufai came late to the party and you can see what has happened to him because the man does not forget. So initially you were playing me. Eventually you came to support me after I had garnered support in other places. I mean, you are welcome. But make I win first now. So I knew there was a part of me, even though I wanted Osinbajo to win, I was playing it up on Twitter that nobody's finished, but I knew in my mind that, you know, this man is going to get a ticket because I wanted Osinbajo to win because we would have just railroaded him in the elections. It would have been very bad for the APC.
But I have a question, right? And this, obviously, Buhari has passed and may he rest in peace. And all of those good things. I'm about to ask a real question. What is it about Buhari, right, that has made people cast aspersions on him when a cursory reading of just history would be like, things came to this guy and like if it was in American terms, you're like, you're not like that. Like, you're not built like that. The reason why I say this is you had people like Amaechi, you had like all these other people who were waiting for him to come there, but nothing in his history had shown that he was that guy.
Yeah.
So what was it that even Emefiele tried to run for president, right? So what was it about... Or what is it about Buhari, now that we can give like a understanding of his legacy, what was it about him that would always make people be like, you know, even when he was running for president the first time, would say, okay, he wears slippers, he's so humble, he's so this. It's like, bro, I'm so confused. Like, where are we getting all these assumptions from? So what is it about Buhari the person that made people always assume he was capable of doing things that he hadn't even shown the capacity to be able to do? Can you break that down? And even before you do that, sorry, I liken this, and I said this before, like, the electorate in every country has like a sixth sense. I believe that, right? So when a man like Buhari has come to you 4 or 5 times to say, hey, make me president, and you have denied him, whether you like it or not, there's something about him that's telling you
that, yeah,
he's not the guy. Now we ended up in a situation where Goodluck Jonathan was not necessarily maybe people's cup of tea. And then they're like, okay, this shadow lover that we have here that's been chasing us. Let's give him a chance. But you were right from the first go. So my question then is, I've always just been puzzled. What was it about Buhari that made these people always continuously cast aspersions on him? Like, what was that about?
I think it's a cultural thing with Nigerians, because this old Spartan lifestyle is not corrupt. Let me just go into something that even younger people follow. Every time, I don't watch Big Brother, but every time there's Big Brother, people on my timeline complain that Nigerians are always voting for the ones that look local or this thing.
They look local.
Like, there's always that underdog, thing. Underdog, basically. So Buhari is somebody like that. It looks like a front of the mill guy, somebody that is just a random guy. It doesn't look like a rich person. It doesn't look like an ex-general that was president. When you see Obasanjo and his carriage, you know that this guy used to be president. When you see Tinubu, you know. When you see like proper rich Nigerians, you know. But Buhari looks like somebody that you can pass on the road and be like, oh, that guy used to be president. So I think that thing appeals to Nigerians, because Nigerians are very religious. Religious preaches humility and things like that. And even people that don't live like that respect it in people. Because I don't know. I have friends that, you know, I've seen them on the come up. I know when they were Spartan. I know when they got money. And I don't think they want to behave the same way. But they respect it. Where is she on Busha? That's nice. So people still respect it in people, even if it's an act, because I can't act that way. So even if you're acting it out, I mean, fair enough to you. So I think that's why people put a lot of things on him. They put that messianic image on him. Like, if this guy can still stay grounded despite all the power that he has, despite if I'm commanding 11 million votes, I'm walking in here with like a chip on my shoulder. I'm not just going to be some random guy. So I think that's a cultural issue, from religion, from like even our families, what people have preached to their children. I know it makes people give that undeserved respect, unmerited respect to him. And they always assume that he had the power or capability to do even more. It doesn't. It's just an humble guy. But, you know, that thought, like, oh, he retires to this farmhouse with 150 cows. And it's a very nice story to tell. I was on the Jonathan team in 2015. And, you know, I was breaking my head, because in 2011, we sold the no-shoe story. But now he's president for 4 years. He's a rich guy. And we are contesting against this guy that they were taking pictures of him in his rundown house. And I knew that they are just going to vote for this person more than my candidate, because they can no longer, you know, have anything with my candidate. There's no attachment anymore. In 2011, it was, look at this guy. He was a university lecturer, becomes deputy governor. It was a Nigerian story. We like unmerited favor. All of a sudden, he wants to be president. You are the one that will stand against that. Like, are you a bad person? So it was a good story to tell. But by 2015, aside from every other thing that was going on, like insecurity and all, Buhari had a better story to tell by then. And a lot of traditional PDP base, you know, went back against Jonathan. Buhari, for the first time, had the Christian votes in the North Central, which you were not going to expect that a fundamentalist Muslim was going to have. But at the end of the day, he did get those votes, and it changed, you know, everything. I don't think like the North Central had like a come together to vote for a Christian thing again. So that's one of those things.
You're a history buff like me, right? And I was reflecting about this the other day. When you look throughout Nigeria's history, and even in our most recent modern democratic process, right, it always feels like we always sometimes as a people collectively end up making the wrong choice. So I'll give you what I mean. the first coup in 1966, at the time, they're thinking, these people have to go. This is the worst this country is going to be, blah, blah, blah. Not knowing that the journey to hell, this was going to be heaven compared to what it was. And I remember I was reflecting on the leaders we had at that time, the Tafawa Balewas, the Saradunas, the Nnamdi Azikiwe, Awolowo. Bro, we would pay our kidneys right now to bring back those sort of leaders, right? So when you reflect on Nigerian history and you see the choices that we've made as a collective, when we're saying, hey, this thing that we're experiencing, we think is the worst thing, not realizing that there's still hell coming. Why do we seem to misjudge the arc of history? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I think there are several reasons why we do these things. 2015, for example, I was against a lot of my friends because obviously they felt I was supporting PDP for, you know, maybe financial reasons or whatnot. They could not understand, like, oh, we are yearning for change and you are trying to vote for Jonathan. I was laying down the economic results to them and telling them that Buhari is a statist, that this is what he's going to do. He's just going to print a shitload of money. You're going to have bad inflation. Everything that eventually happened, I was telling them. But, you know, people, Nigerians get swayed with, like, emotions, or many people are going to one side. They don't stop to think, like, if a fire break happens here now, people just start... sad story, the bomb blast that happened in Lagos and people just ran into a canal. Like, a lot of people did not even know there was a bomb blast. They just saw people running and they kept running. So that's how we make those decisions, that we don't try to analyze things. Like, oh, everybody's saying this now. Why are you against this? And everybody just gets swayed into that. There was an attempted coup against President Tinubu recently. And when I got into the details of it, I realized they did not have a plan to actually just take over or have somebody take over. They wanted to just, like, kill everybody first, and in the middle of that chaos, you can then have something. And one of their plans was that people were going to come out in support of the coup. And then I had a lot of Nigerians telling me that that was not going to happen. I said, you've not been talking to people. If a coup happens today, Nigerians will come out to the streets to celebrate it. It's unfortunate, but that's what they believe, like, sure. And even though it's wrong, but that's initial euphoria, they are going to do it. Then the next 2 weeks, they're like, ah, I'm sure this thing will do make sense. Yeah. Because I have people telling me about Buhari within, like, 3 months, like, ah, come on. That's the way they tell me, ah, come on. Like, say, so yeah. we just, like, have that rush of blood to the head first before sitting down to analyze issues. I don't know if it's from, like, our educational system, not, like, encouraging critical thinking, but it's something that keeps happening. Obviously, somebody that is a right-wing nut job would just say we have low IQ or something as a people, but I don't think it's that simplistic. I think it's something that, as a group, we don't come together well to make critical decisions in a way that everybody knows that, okay, we are doing this because of this. Because now, Buhari election, a lot of people had Northern agenda. That was just their own. It's the time of the North. Jonathan was using expired time. It's time for a Northerner. They had that, which is fine if they want to have that. But then I had friends that are not with this Northern agenda, and you are just swayed. Like, are you dumb? It's fine if you want Buhari, but you have to understand that the people that you are in bed with, they have another entire agenda from you, and they don't, you are just a useful idiot to them. They don't care. So when you are going into those type of coalitions, you need to understand what is in it for me. It is fair enough that you want change, but you have to understand that these people that you are going with, they have something else in mind. And that happens a lot when people don't understand that. And you talked about the first coup, it's the same mistake that they made. There was no agenda for it to be tribal. But in carrying out everything, in everything coming out, it started looking like, oh, wait, where are these guys? Why have you not killed this guy? Where is this guy? Then everybody starts asking questions.
Yeah,
I'm actually, what I'm curious about is, because you spoke about people going abroad, getting educated, and not relating back here. What advice do you give to those people? Because interestingly enough, in the past year that we have been here or moved back, we've seen a lot of Nigerians from different parts of the world move back to Nigeria. Maybe they feel like this is a time. But how do they get entrenched into local politics?
I think you need to have that genuine love for politics. Mm. You need to actually want to help people. You need to be a sociable person, not like smug or something. You need to have it at the back of your mind that the first maybe 10 years will be sacrificed.
Mm.
Trust me, people have gotten lucky, gotten in and they rise to the top. But it's not always like that. That's an outlier story. And I don't like debating with outliers. You need to understand that time sacrifice, that human sacrifice or human contact with people. I think ultimately we need to be led by the generation that has gone abroad and come back. It might sound controversial in some places, but I think because of the experience that they've had, because of the level of education, because of the global network that they have, we need to be led next by that generation. Mm. The problem is for them to sweat it out in local politics. I've seen a lot of people falter. I consulted for a guy that came back from the UK. He wanted to be an House of Rep member. And before his primaries, I was telling him some things he should do, some places he should visit. And half the time, he felt it was unnecessary. And I said, guy, it's fine. You paid me my money. I'm not. But if you don't do these things, you are just going to go back again and come back in another 4 years. And I said this thing, you know, and ultimately that was what happened.
Mm.
And he hit me up recently and I'm like, let me guess, 2027. So I think there are a lot of things to learn about human beings that people don't want to learn because they feel like those people are just wrong. Like maybe I disagree with Chika or something and I'm like, they will never have like an inflection point. Like that's it. I don't want to see your face anymore. So, but politicians don't work like that. You see somebody that is just like an idiot on social media. Like, you know this person is just an idiot. A politician will be like, let's listen to the guy now. Like, let's have a meeting with him. So and that's how these people end up in those rooms. And you're like, why are they entertaining these people? Because to them, it's like, oh, as stupid as he is, there is something that we can do together. But for young people, maybe because social media has fragmented us in like, there are some people's following now that they can never see what is happening on the other side. Like they're in their own echo chamber. They will, so that's why they get shocked when they see somebody's opinion on something like, you see the way they will be railing and angry because they cannot imagine that 2025 somebody is thinking like this. But if you want to be in politics, you cannot be like that because there are so many idiots or opinions that are I've been baked from people's childhood that you can't just unlearn them or this thing. You still need to be friends with them. They still need to have friends. You'll be like, I'll not be you be friends with that guy. So I won't be friends with you anymore too. So it's a problem that I've seen with young people. They don't know how to have different caliber of friends, mm-hmm. like from every sphere of life. And I think that's one way that politicians have, you know, been cheating us because they are able to bring everybody together.
Mm.
They are able to organize everybody together and we are paying a premium for that because I always tell people, every time you are not in politics and somebody else is in it, you are paying them. They are collecting that premium because they are able to do things that you are not going to do. You are simply not going to do it, but they can do it. They can stand into 4 a.m. with a meeting with a random nobody. But you need your sleep. You have another email to push in the morning. You have this to do and that. So we are paying a premium for being unable to do that, to bring people together, all sorts of people. And trust me, there are all sorts of people.
We see this all the time. And I wanted to talk about the hubris of power, right? I think the example I'll use is Mephi, the former CBN governor, right? At the time, it felt like, again, from reports, because me, I wasn't here, so you guys can help correct me. But people felt it was a bit heavy-handed, Lord of the Manor, the whole thing. And then, you know, a new administration fall from grace. And there's so many examples like this. The one thing I've always been curious about is it that, because you said that these guys are very intelligent guys, right? So intelligence also enables you to be able to extrapolate into the future. What is it about their time in those places of power that makes them feel like this is going to be the end all be all. And they can extrapolate or imagine a world in which they will no longer have this power so that maybe I shouldn't make as many enemies on my way up so that on my way down, maybe I can have AC in jail. So on.
I think Murphy in particular, the major problem with him was that he had way too much power. So you have to understand that he was a CBN governor when we had the initial foreign exchange crisis. And because Buhari did not want to devalue the currency, he created a two-tier system where some people had access to a particular figure, other people have access to another one. And you can just sit down in your house and round trip and make millions of dollars a day.
Hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions a day. And this is what Murphy and his gang were doing, which was fine. Because even, I tell people, without Murphy, there's no Dangote refinery. He was the one that was providing the, Alhaji can come and fight me anywhere. You know, he was the one that was providing the subsidized dollars for that. And that's why BUA will never get his refinery to stand up, because he's not going to get subsidized dollars. Nobody's getting it anymore right now. I mean, in that volume. So he had immense power. When you are the one supplying Dangote so much dollars, you are the one supplying Buhari's cabal so much dollars, NNPC, everybody's coming to you, everybody's calling your phone, I need this, I need that. I think it's natural for you to get into your head. It's like watching the Diddy documentary and seeing and seeing like the trajectory, and you're like, you can't just be human anymore. You cannot think on the same plane. I understand the intelligence part, being able to anticipate the future, but you're already living in the future, because now you have so many houses all over the world. You have this, you have that. You're like, even if these people squeeze me down to my bones are like calcium enriched. There's no, like, there's no way I'm going out on this. So it's very hard for them to anticipate that. And I don't think he would have had a problem with Tinubu in particular if he didn't do that Naira policy that was supposed to, because...
What was his thinking behind that?
Okay, so...
The real thinking, not the one that was official. Yeah.
So the thing is, at that point, Atiku had infiltrated the Buhari cabal well for them to support him. And their thinking was that Tinubu had too much money for them to fight vote buying. So if we take cash off the streets, you need to buy votes with promissory notes. Nobody's voting for you with promissory notes.
Yeah,
like, Baba, I will give you next week. If they don't get their cash right now, then so their thinking was...
Hey, they were not doing many bank transfers.
You know, that period, bank transfers, it was a problem as well. So the major thinking was that this is one way to fight these people. Now, it's possible, I don't believe in coincidences, that they were altruistic to not make either one of Atiku or Tinubu to be able to buy votes. It's possible. I don't think that's what happened. I think they were targeting Tinubu himself, which he knew that they were targeting him, because vote buying was a large part of his plan as well, of his strategy. So they felt like if they go after him like that, it will make the election seem freer and fairer to them. But ultimately, it didn't work. Because even Atiku, it affected him. And I don't think Tinubu was going to forgive him for that. And there are so many people in, like, you know that Tinubu's camp is like, they're in the major financial capital, which is Lagos. They're the ones running things. Murphy goes to Abuja and starts running things without their buying. So there was friction already that, you know what, we are coming to take over everything and we are going to squeeze you down to the bones for what you did, because it was not with them, which to me could have easily been with them. You guys are in the same party and all that, but it was not with them. It was with his own people. And even Dangote was feeling the hits at the beginning, because he sponsored Matiko as well. So,
but why not flee though? Because if you know that, you know, these people are might not like me, maybe I go to one of my houses somewhere in the world. Like, what is the thing about, what is the calculus around the power, staying? So they think that it insulates them.
Yeah, and it felt like it was going to be protected by Buhari or somebody. And it didn't really, you know, there are some times that you hurt people and you don't know how far you've done it. It's when they react that you're like, I don't know. Say,
I didn't know you were vexing like this.
So I think it just felt like, oh, we're just deploying politics.
Yeah.
nothing deep.
They didn't think but, it was personal.
Yeah, but they took it personal. And it happens to people a lot of times. You know, you hurt somebody and you're like, yeah, no, I'm just get. And then you see the person's revenge or their attempt at revenge. You're like, whoa.
I've gone far now.
So I think, I think that's one of the things that it did not expect, it did not realize how deep it had gone. He didn't expect their reaction to be like that.
Okay.
And yeah.
So we're about to jump into a rapid fire segment, but I think elections are coming up, not in 2027. Mm-hmm. What projections, what can you leave our audience with? Like, what do you see happening? Do you believe, you know, Tinubu gets a second term? Do you believe another candidate comes up? What are you thinking?
Right now, and this is backed by polling because I run a polling company as well. Right now, unless something changes.
As of today,
I think it will be the easiest re-election since 99, yes. As of today. 24 hours is a long time in politics. But as of today, as we are sitting here on these dates, I think it will be the easiest re-election in history. It's unfortunate that it's happening that way. My SY party, the PDP, has been absolutely decimated by Wike because Tambuwal stood up that day. Because Tambuwal stood up that day, it has been totally decimated. Some governors are trying to rescue it. I don't think their rescue mission is going to work. The ADC coalition has not gotten the momentum it should get. One person that they need, Peter Obi, is still like considering if he should join them, and I think he wants to run. Mm-hmm. If he's running, Atiku wants to run as well. They are not running on the same tickets. We have a three-way vote. There will be vote splitting again, which is what I was screaming about in the last election. Tinubu has much more governors in his pocket today than he had in 2023. Much more. Nigeria is approaching a one-party state. I think if you do a deep dive into polling, it's not like people want to vote either Tinubu or APC, but people are not seeing options.
Yeah,
and people themselves, and you know what I said about Nigerians just swaying, where people are people are saying that, oh, it's impossible to remove this man. So instead of fighting it, they are just agreeing to it and saying, okay, we just have to join the wheel. There is nothing stopping him right now. Obviously, a lot of things can happen before then. They've had the diplomatic success with the US thing. I think that was one of the...
Oh, you think so?
I think for now,
yeah,
it has been handled well. That was one of the things that was going to be a sore point for them.
For our viewers, it's the whole Trump... talking about Nigeria and, you know, the things happening in the northern part of Nigeria and the killings and the genocide and all of that, just to give them context. Okay. I think that they've handled that pretty well from a diplomatic perspective.
Yes, okay. Because the last statement from the delegation that came from the US, they didn't say anything about the Christian genocide. They said the government is working on this and that. I think the hearing that they had in the House, there was a lot of pushback from Democrats. I think some lobbyists are doing so.
But do you also believe it was really about that, about this whole Christian thing? I think I'm more skeptical. It felt like a smoke screen, like
for the US.
Yeah, for the US, because think, like waking up in 2025 to care about Christians in the North.
So it's a lot of things. There had always been lobbying on for some groups for the US to recognize the killings in the North Central. It was convenient for Trump at the time that he had the Epstein files problem. It was very convenient for him. From a geopolitical point of view, for the US as well. All over the Sahel, Russian dictators are taking over. They no longer, the base in Niger has fallen to Russian hands. Mm. So they need a base in Nigeria, basically. So that's, I'm sure it's what it's peaking, the agreements that they must have signed by now.
Do you think the rare metals also have anything to do with it?
I think it's a part of it as well. So it's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
And it's easy to, you know, get people's. Obviously, MAGA is becoming expansionist, that they want to be the defenders of Christians worldwide. And it's easy to tap into that. And I don't think Nigerians mind, as long as there's somebody talking about the killings or something. I don't think Nigerians mind. Yeah. It's all part of that agenda. And I, for now, they've handled it well, and it was going to be a sore point for them going to the elections, because it would have been easy for the US to back a Christian candidate and try to, you know, shake up Nigeria, even though that would help Tinubu in the Muslim North. But it's going to, if the US is backing somebody, logistics and media is with the person, and that's the major money you spend in elections. Yeah. So no matter how president or you are, if there is major money for logistics and media for somebody else, you are in serious trouble. Mm. It's like what happened in the Honduras election that Trump just came out and so it's.
Before we wrap up, let's talk about the last election, right? I think the previous election before the last one, yeah, you had PDP, APC, you had Peter Obi and Atiku on one ticket. The last election, they split the three tickets. And I saw from your tweets from day one, you were early on this thing, to give you credit. You were screaming that there is no possible way that Peter Obi is going to be able to win this election. Mm-hmm. Now, looking back, right, you were obviously right. It was most likely better to, if people wanted to choose both, to not split the ticket. What was the thought process behind, from your perspective, them splitting the votes? And what do you think they could have done better, looking back in hindsight, from both PDP, Labour, and obviously APC won? But if you were to advise them again today, looking back, what could they have done better?
I think when you look at the 2019 elections, Atiku won 18 states, Buhari won 19. We pushed him far. In fact, we pushed Buhari so far, he changed the Chief Justice before the election, because he knew that if we rig this thing, that we are going to lose in court. Like, I organized protests against Onogen. He removed the Chief Justice and just put a random guy from Bauchi or something like Abiyagi who speak outside to each other.
So you believe it was rigged? The first
2019,
yeah,
I think so. I it was not heavily rigged, but the margin of error was so small that, you know, and that's why I hate close elections, because it's easy to rig. You need to properly beat an incumbent, like properly. Fast forward to 2023, we already had the numbers. It's simple. We add the numbers. Atiku and Obi add the numbers. But the problem is, and I want to be as fair as possible, because there are a lot of people that disagree with me as well. People felt power needs to shift to the south. My problem with that, Tinubu is the strongest southerner on any ballot.
Yeah.
It's fine. You guys are supporting Peter Obi, but Peter Obi is not going to get as much votes in the north as Tinubu will get. And that is ultimately what will decide the elections. After how many years of Buhari, 8 years of Buhari, a Muslim, you need a Christian. That's fine as well. The problem now is, if you look at the Nigerian map, we have an electoral college in Nigeria that most people don't know, and I hope your viewers learn from this. It's not just majority of the votes. You need to win two-thirds in 25% of the states. So you need to win two-thirds. I mean, you need to have 25% in two-thirds of the states. So you need to have 25% in about 23, 24 states. Mm. The problem is just opening a Nigerian map. If we had one here, I will point it out to you. Peter Obi can have majority of the votes in an election. It's possible. Like, I've seen the numbers. But he can't have 25% in two-thirds of the states. There are 17 northern states. Mm. The people that wrote that knew what they were doing. You need a large incursion into the north to be the Nigerian president. Peter Obi was getting 5,000 votes in some northern states. So there's no way. If he overdid, he was the only candidate that overshot his base in the last election. Atiku had his base contested by Tinubu. Tinubu had his base contested by Obi. Obi won his own entire base. So that's the maximum votes he's going to ever get in an election. And he still had 25% in only 14 states. Because the states that they don't like him, they really do not like him. Unlike Atiku and Obi, that, you know, they can use vote buying, political power, and this thing. But when you already tell people you don't give shishi, political leaders are like, fine, see you later.
You don't give shishi, like, yeah, you don't pay out.
So, like, fine, see you later. But Atiku and Tinubu are able to go into some states and fight for 25% with negotiating with political leaders or doing some vote buying or doing this. Obi swept North Central, for example, but still lost Benue. Should have been easy for him. Atiku had his base contested by Tinubu. Now, when you have a three-way ticket, you're only helping the incumbent, because people don't want to vote for the incumbent. Now you're giving them two good choices instead of one. Tinubu became president with 36% of the votes. So majority of people that woke up that morning to vote did not want him as president. When they were waking up, like, I was voting today, they did not want Tinubu to vote. But the question is, do I want Atiku or do I want Peter Obi? At some point in our own strategy room, that's with Atiku, I pushed that we need to let people understand this vote splitting part. A lot of older people did not see my point. That's why I went rogue and started doing it myself on Twitter, because they felt like Peter Obi was our VP last election. Why should we be afraid of him? But I was seeing numbers that they were not seeing.
Yeah.
In fact, I conducted a poll in Kaduna. And when I saw the numbers, I told my team that this is impossible. So I used my own money to run another poll. And I'm like, what? We are in soup if Peter Obi is doing this well in Kaduna. And I showed some people, they're like, oh, you don't come with your this thing. This is like something serious. He's getting over 100K in Adamawa.
Yeah.
That's Atiku State with the majority Christian. Like, I saw it. I was still saying nonsense on Twitter and betting with people that he's not going to get 1 million votes, even though my own numbers
were telling you.
He was different.
So, and I knew that the more votes, that's why I got increasingly angry towards the election, because I knew the more votes he gets, the less he's taking, the more he's taking from Atiku, the more possibility for Tinubu to win. And then they now went ahead, and part of their strategy was to release polls that was winning the election. And I called every single poster that did this from stairs. I spoke to all of them. I'm polling as well. Can you show me how he's going to get 25% in 2026?
This is Peter
Obi. Yes. Yeah. Like, it's fine if you think he's going to win majority of the votes, which I, at that point, I also felt was possible if he overshot his numbers. But the problem is the Electoral College. How is he going to get 25% in 2006? Nobody could show me. But you release your poll that is going to win the election and you are swaying people's opinion. But you know that he's not going to get that. And if he doesn't get that, so I realized that what their plan was to force a rerun, eliminate Atiku, make Peter run against Tinubu, then Atiku would have to support Peter Obi. That was never going to happen, because the margin of difference is within the rigging margin. And when you have the margin of difference within the rigging margin, you are going to lose to the incumbent. It's as simple as that. If you want to beat the incumbent, you need to all be on one side, and you need to beat them overwhelmingly. Like, it needs to be total. But we were running on margins against somebody as crazy as Tinubu. Like, now we want to run on margins again, because as it looks to me, Atiku wants to run. Obi also wants to run. I don't know how they are going to do it. Left alone to me, if I was in Obi's shoes, I would run. I'm not trying to see anything. I think the best ticket is for both of them to run together. But if I was in his shoes with the numbers I had the last time, and with the youth energy, I think a lot of people will be disappointed if he goes to deputize Atiku. Saying this now, some of my people in Atiku's team will say I'm just doing style up so that he won't come and accept. But it's the fact, and it's why I told them that there's no way to defeat Tinubu, because there's no incentive right now for Obi to take VP position. There's no incentive, because a lot of young people behind him would not agree.
Yeah.
Like, they were vicious against Atiku. They insulted him, they insulted his tribe, they insulted his religion. Like, they came after him for the Deborah tweets deleted and all. So I don't know how you're going to convince them that let this person just be president and we'll be behind them. I don't see how it happens. But I want young people that are just getting into politics, especially people that are watching this podcast, to understand that when you have a situation where you need to remove the incumbent, and you believe that either one of the candidates might be marginally better, they don't have to be 100% better, might be marginally better, you should always go for the one that is more likely to win, regardless of what you're actually saying. In the last American election, when JFK, Kennedy, when he started RFK, when he started having when he started pulling some numbers from Trump's base, what did Trump do?
He brought him inside,
because you don't need, he was running against an incumbent, you don't need little margins. He started, you know, getting numbers out from, he was, even though he was a Democrat, but the, his base was within the Republican base, he went to pull him in. And that's where I'll blame Atiku for not pulling Obi back in, or neither did he, was he able to pull Wike back in. So you have to question yourself, like, your judgment of the situation. You want to be president and you had two problems. You couldn't solve one. And Tinubu used the advantage and brought Wike to his side. So Obi was left hanging. I would have probably just been following Obi to every campaign until he just says, okay, sir.
I'm coming.
I'm coming. Because you needed to solve one. And every time people ask me, what can we do to turn this election around? You have to solve one. You need to get on your knees for Wike or get on your knees for Obi, because you are losing votes in the South. And Southerners are saying it's our turn. And trust me, a lot of people that are against Tinubu, at that point, it became about ego. Like, this country do not belong to Northerners.
Yeah.
So even if it's Tinubu that is winning, as long as it's a Southerner, I don't care. A lot of people that wanted to vote Obi, they were like, we need to draw the line in the sand now. Because I was, as a Southerner that was campaigning for Atiku, I felt alienated a lot of times on the campaign ground. Because people sit me down, older people that have respected me for years, and they ask me, so if Atiku wins now, so we have Fulani for 16 years. I said, it's just first time now. We never talk second time. So after Atiku now, we'll bring another Fulani. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not here to have a tribal conversation with you. I'm telling you to support my candidate. I'm like, and they're like, fine, I won't vote for the Tinubu, but I'm not voting for your man either. I'd rather just sit down at home.
Yeah.
Or I vote for the one that my kids want, and that's better of you. So they were totally blindsided down south, and there was not, there was no good strategy to it.
I want to talk about why aunties are so important to African history. Aunties represent curators of the African experience, and oftentimes they have been unacknowledged. They have literally held our archives before they were archives. They were literally institutions before we had institutions. They held so many important cultural artifacts, such as the way we braid our hair, the recipes of our cookings. They represent abundance. There's literally a reason why we call an African culture rich aunties. And we believe that with partnering with Anthony, we're able to showcase this type of history through art. So to connect to African history and get a piece of the Anthony and Afropolitan collection called Auntie, make sure to click the link in the description. And this is your way you can support our channel.
We've come to a rapid fire segment. This is where we ask you a question. The first thought that comes into your mind, please give us. What's your favorite Nigerian food?
Pounded yam.
And?
Egusi. Or Eforiro.
Okay, digital ads or word of mouth?
Both.
Well, usually, I think you're supposed to choose one, but
okay.
Which one do you think will? Which one has edge?
Word of mouth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Political recognition or name recognition or money or vote buying, basically. What moves an election more?
Name recognition.
Really? Yeah. In Nigeria?
People collect money from both sides.
Okay.
Like I said, everybody pays.
True, true, true. Okay, let's round up.
So the last question we ask every single guest on this podcast is, who do you want to see in that chair and whose story needs to be told?
Well, I think because we spoke about NSAS, you should get one of the people from FEMCO here to expand on what happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have any particular person?
I don't want to throw because they're like, oh yeah, the one that spoke about me. But I think somebody that was like core in it,
okay,
it would be very good for people to understand. I know it's a topic they don't want to touch anymore. And a lot of times when it comes up and people even accuse them of fraud and this thing, they don't come out to defend themselves. But I think it's a story that should be told and they should stop shying away from it.
I agree.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.